basically what's happened up until this point is Jacob is now being called to answer for the sins that he has committed in his past. Jacob, his name literally means deceiver or usurper. His name literally means to take what's not his so that he can get ahead in life. And he has lived up to that name. He deceived his brother twice to steal his birthright, and he deceived his dad, who was blind at the time. He tricked his blind old dad, which is really, really sad, actually. And he made so many mistakes that he ended up having to run away from home and flee to his uncle for 20 years. And his uncle took advantage of him for 20 years that he was there. And he ended up marrying his uncle's two daughters, which is pretty sick. And he ended up having two concubines on top of that, having kids with all these women. He had a really jacked up marital life, obviously. And things became so toxic between him and his uncle that he had to flee. And he came back to, God was calling him back to the original place that he had run from. He called him back home. And last service we talked a little bit about that, about what does it look like to confront mistakes that you've made in the past. How should you treat that? How should you go about it? And what ended up happening is he met God. He was freaking out. He was panicked. He thought his brother was going to kill him, rightfully so. So he panicked, and God ended up meeting him, and he ended up wrestling him, and he ended up dislocating his hip. And through that brokenness, through Jacob finally getting to a place where he can no longer think his way out or talk his way out of his circumstances, he finally came to the place where he had to trust God. He had no choice but to trust God. And through that broken place, God said, "You're not going to be called Jacob anymore. You're not going to be called deceiver anymore. I'm going to give you a new name. I'm going to give you a new identity." And he says, "Your name is now going to be Israel," which means someone who is led by God or someone who rules with God. And in the New Testament, we're given a similar promise. God says that he's going to give us a new name, a new identity, we're going to be a new creation in him. So if we've grown up in our lives and we've been cowards all our lives, like Jacob, running away from our problems and not dealing with them, God says, "I'm going to give you a name of bravery." You know, if you grow up and you're more like David, who he wasn't a coward, but he was kind of a hothead. You know, he dealt with his problems head on, but he was a dude that was so hardcore that at one point somebody just insulted him and he was ready to wipe out that guy's entire family and burn his farm to the ground. So, you know, you might be more like David, where, dude, you're able to confront stuff, but you're kind of a jerk about it, you know. And so God's going to take a guy like David and he's going to make him humble and kind and gentle. And no matter what our bad identities are, God says that he's going to give us a new one. But even though, like all of us, even though he had this miraculous encounter with God, Jacob immediately forgot it, and he went back to his old ways. Because he encounters his brother, and his brother forgives him for what he did. And his brother's like, "Hey, come home. Man, Dad misses you. This is going to be great. We're going to be able to hang out just like the old times." And Jacob's like, "Hey, man, like, you know, my hip's out of socket, so I'll catch up, you know." And instead of going there, he ends up going somewhere else because he's not ready to confront his dad yet. He's not ready to confront his dad yet. So that's why Genesis 34 happens. It's Jacob's fault. It's Jacob's fault that this whole scenario happens. And this situation is going to be the final straw in his life. This is going to bring him to the place where he literally has no choice but to go home and to deal with his dad. So this is what happens. I'm not going to read it, but I'm going to explain it to you guys. And the reason I'm not going to read it is because it's long and it's brutal. It's very brutal. Jacob had a daughter. He had at least one daughter. We're not sure how many daughters he actually had, but he had at least one daughter, and her name was Dinah or Dina. Or I don't know how to pronounce it, but whatever. And Dinah, I guess, was a very beautiful girl, and she was out in the field one day alone. And this guy, who was a prince of one of the towns that was neighboring where Jacob was at, he sees her, and he becomes infatuated with her, and he has sex with her. Now, whether or not this sex was consensual is not clear in the passage. There, you could definitely take a lot of what it says as being he raped her, but it's not necessarily what happened. I mean, there's some evidence that it was forced sex. But it says that after he did this with her, he ended up falling in love with her. And he became so infatuated with her, he went to Jacob and he said, "Hey, man, like, your daughter's amazing. She's incredible. Is it okay if I marry her?" And this guy, his name was Shechem, his dad was with him. And his dad's like, "Not only can my son marry your daughter, but could you give your women to our men and they can marry them, and we'll give our women to your men and they can marry them, and we'll be like one community. You can come live with us in our kingdom, basically, is what he's offering. And the people of this kingdom were way on board with this because Jacob was incredibly wealthy. And they're like, dude, if this guy comes in, his daughters are good looking, you know, he's got a ton of goods, we're on board with this. And his sons, so two of his sons were a little bit of hotheads. They were named Simeon, and the other one was Levi. And they went to them and they said, hey, you know, we totally agree with you guys. But the one thing that, there's just one little thing, you know, we're all circumcised. You know, we're certain God gave us this covenant of circumcision. We're all circumcised. Let me explain to you what that is, right? And they went into what it is, and they're like, if you guys get circumcised, we're on board. We're on board. And this guy Shechem, was so in love with Jacob's daughter that he's like, okay. And you got to be pretty sincere about a girl to be willing to cut your manhood, you know, like, and this guy, he's serious, dude. He's like, dude, I'm ready. I mean, forget paying for an engagement ring, right, guys? You know, like that's a new level of commitment that you're willing to do this for a girl. And he's so ready. He does it, and then he commands all of his kingdom to do it. And so they do it. And when something like that happens, right, if you get cut there, you're not going to be doing too great for a couple days, right? You're not going to be able to walk too well. You're not going to be able to move too well. You're probably going to be pretty drunk to get rid of the pain, right? And so Simeon and Levi and the other brothers know this, and this is their plan. So this is an entire kingdom, by the way. This is hundreds, maybe even thousands of people that have done this. And what they do is when they know that everybody's in pain, they know it's the time when everyone circumcised themselves, they come into the town, they come into the kingdom, and they kill everyone. They kill all the men. They slaughter them. So the reason why I say this is a little more brutal than John Wick or you know, like Logan, is because these guys are, they've literally mutilated themselves. They're laying on the ground. They're sick. It would be like going into a hospital and just murking people, just like slicing them up and killing them. And it's not like guns. It's not like, bam, you're dead. It's like taking a sword, cutting people's heads off, sawing off their limbs, you know, like while their wives are in the building, like crying and being like, dude, I don't care. And then they like took their wives as captives and marched them out and like, you know, kept them as like sex slaves and sold them. This is just a gruesome story. There's no way around this. There's no way to look at this and be like, well, you know, it's kind of justifiable, you know, because he had sex with that one girl. It's like, even if it was rape, their response to it was so over the top. It's so over the top. It would be like, you know, that's why I said it's kind of like Taken, you know, where, you know, he takes his daughter and then that dude just goes on a massacre and just kills hundreds of people. Like, that's what happened. You know, one girl got hurt and so thousands of people die, and more than that become slaves to their whims, which is pretty radical. And so when we're looking at the Bible, I hope you guys know, you know, I hope I've been pretty clear about this as we've known through the book of Genesis. You can't look at the Bible and say, these are our role models. Do you guys understand that? If these guys were my role models, I would have a pretty jacked up life, right? I would have a pretty messed up life. If I looked to these guys, I was like, yes, that's how you live, right? Someone does you wrong, you kill their family, man. You wipe them out. You burn them to dust. You don't mess around. You keep it real. You know, these are not good role models. And what this story really shows is it shows, first of all, how messed up these people are. But secondly, it shows the consequences of vengeance, right? So they went out, they got their vengeance, they were satisfied. They're like, dude, we took what was ours. We took care of the situation. We feel good. But, I mean, think about the other neighborhoods that are around them, right? Jacob's not a military. He's not a nation at this point. He doesn't have a city. He just has a couple loose cannon sons, you know, that are just really messed up. You know, he can't handle this. He's like, dude, are you kidding me? This is chapter 35. And, chapter 34 at the end, it says in verse 30, Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me by making me obnoxious. I mean, that's kind of a lightly putting it. But you're troubling me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, They will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I. And they said, should he treat our sister like a harlot? So they're justifying themselves. Like, dude, but he had sex with Dinah, you know, so justice, you know, and that's the way they're thinking. And Jacob's like, dude, they're going to wipe us out. Like, we don't have a military. They're going to come, they're going to kill us. Like, they're not going to let this go. It's not like they're going to be like, oh, yeah, you wiped out a town, it's no big deal. It would be, the equivalent of this would be like this. It would be like if somebody went into Oro Valley and killed everybody in there and then just started living in Oro Valley. It's like, don't you think the rest of Tucson might be like, dude, I think we're going to kill you now. Like, I think we're going to come and just, like, kill you. Like, there's no way we're not. And so Jacob's freaking out. He's like, dude, they're going to murder us. Like, there's no chance. There's no chance we're going to make it through this alive. And the Bible says it this way, and it's 100% true. It says, violence just begets more violence. He who lives by the sword is going to die by the sword. And I saw this pretty clearly when I was in Afghanistan. Like, you know, we'd be going out, we'd be taking care of business, we'd be killing people. But with every person we killed, that dude that we killed had kids, and he had a wife. And guess what those kids are thinking? Dude, these Americans killed my dad. Like, I'm going to grow up and I'm going to kill them, you know? And so the more we kill them, the more they want to kill us back. I mean, look at the Middle East. How many wars have we fought there in the last century? You know, and it's not like they're like, oh, we give up, you know, we're done with the fighting. They're just getting more bitter and more angry and wanting to kill us even more. The only way, by the way, if you guys want to know this, the only way to stop this aggression, to stop aggression from happening, there's actually a couple ways. One is annihilation. If we went in there and just nuked them to nothing, then yeah, there's not going to be any vengeance anymore because they're all dead. You know, that would work out. But if we do that, the consequence is, how nice are people going to be to us if they start fighting us? Right? What kind of precedent is that sending for the rest of the world if we just nuked a country off the map? You know, like the United Nations might get a little bit upset about that. Right? So there would be some consequences in that way. The other way you can do it is called assimilation. You know what that is? That's where you take people out of their nation and you bring them into your nation and you force them to adjust to your customs and your way of living. Have we done that before? What about like the slaves? Did we do that to them? Yeah, we kind of did that to them, didn't we? So you could assimilate people, and that's pretty gruesome as well. And we don't have the stomach for that. And then the final thing that you could do to somebody is you could ignore them. But if you ignore them, they're just going to get pissed at you and rise up and kill you. That's kind of what we're doing right now. We're just destabilizing their government, and then we're like, and then they're just going to be our allies now. You know, we're gonna come in, drop a bunch of bombs, kill a bunch of folk, and then they're going to love us. You know, and they're going to be pro-America. They're going to be waving the flag. Is that what's happening though? Right? You reap what you sow, is what the Bible's saying. ISIS, that's our fault. I mean, when you look at the situation, we made that happen. Now, you can make the argument that Saddam Hussein was worse than ISIS, but at the end of the day, ISIS is our fault. We destabilized the government, we pissed off a bunch of people, and now they want what's theirs. And that's what's happened. The only way to, like I said, the only way to not let that happen is annihilation or assimilation. You could annihilate them, or you could take them out of their country and you could force them to assimilate with you. But Jacob doesn't have the manpower to do this at this point. Right? He's like, dude, we're going to get annihilated. They're going to come, they're going to kill us. Dude, it's over. And in your life, you're going to see this as well. Your need to take vengeance has consequences. If you want to get even with somebody, there's going to be consequences for that. You can do it, but there's going to be consequences for it. So if somebody, one of your friends or whatever, like, you know, does something wrong by you and you're like, you know, I'm not going to take that sitting down. You go beat the crap out of them. You could do that, but how is he going to think about that? Is he going to be like, oh, he beat me up. I'm never going to do anything against him again. You know, he taught me a lesson. You know, it's over now. No, right? There's going to be some vengeance and bitterness that's going to come back to you. So violence is always going to beget more violence. There's no way around that. There's always consequences for the decisions that we make. Now, that being said, I'm not saying that violence is never necessary. Sometimes violence needs to happen. But no matter what, there's always consequences for our actions. World War II, when I look at World War II, I would say that's a necessary war. However, was there consequences for fighting that war? Yeah, a lot. right? There was a lot of consequences, but it definitely beats the alternative. If someone broke into my house and tried to kill my wife, you better believe I'd use violence to stop them. But there would be consequences for my action, right? And I'd have to be aware of that. And what I have to determine in my heart is, like, are the consequences worth the action? And a lot of times they are, but a lot of times they aren't. A lot of times we need to learn how to forgive and let go. And that's something only God can teach us how to do, how to allow justice to be in the hands of God. That's something that's very, very difficult to learn how to do, but something we need to learn how to do. Now, Jacob is going to learn this lesson. Chapter 35, verse 1. God said to Jacob, "Arise, go to Bethel, and dwell there, and make an altar to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother." Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away your foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves. Change your garments. Then let us arise, go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and has been with me in the way that I have gone." So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands, and in the earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree, which was by Shechem. So Jacob realizes that God is the only one that can help him right now. So he's going to God and he's asking for help. He's finally ready to submit to whatever God says. And we know that Jacob is ready to do this because he does something physical. He gets rid of his gods. Which might shock a lot of us. Be like, yeah, I thought these were like people who loved God, right? And they have idols? Like, isn't that weird to you guys? That they're like worshiping idols and God? The truth is that we all do it. You know what the word idol means in Hebrew? You know what it is? Ever know the definition of that? It means nothing, right? The word idol just literally means nothing. You're worshiping nothings. And the reason why the Hebrews gave it that word, gave it that title, that definition, is because what they're saying is if you worship anything above God, at the end of the day, that thing that you're worshiping is actually a nothing. And in our lives, all of us, me included, I have nothings in my life. I have things that I turn to that are supposedly supposed to help me, but they end up not helping me so much, right? It could be anything. It could be my job. You know, a lot of times, maybe you turn to your job. A lot of men do this. Turn to their job to find some sort of a feeling of validation or sustenance. I had one staff sergeant in the Marine Corps that he loved staying late. He used to volunteer to stay late for work. He would work all the time, and he was a jerk. And I never realized why he did that. And then one time I was with him in the office, and his phone rang, and it was his wife. And the ringtone he had for his wife was a yelping dog. It's like, ruff, 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 ruff. And I was like, dude, that's the ringtone for your wife? And he's like, yeah, I hate her. And then all of a sudden, I realized why this dude likes working late. Why does he like working late? He doesn't like going home. He's like, y'all want to go home? And you could tell from, I mean, think about it. It's a yelping dog, right? What that shows me is that this is a wife that, what does she do to him? Nags, orders him around. And so he goes home and he gets no respect. He feels trampled on. His wife nags him all the time. So why does he like going to work? He feels respected. He feels important. He feels like he has validation. Do you guys get that? That's a nothing. That's an idol in his life. It's a nothing. Because in the reality is like he's compensating for his cowardice at home by picking on other people. Right? I mean, he's a coward. He's going home and he's letting his 90-pound wife run the whole household, right? And then he goes to work and he tries to be a man, right? And he tries to be tough. Like, dude, that's totally backwards. That's not right. And a lot of people do stuff like that. Or they use relationships. They don't feel like they have a lot of insecurity inside of their life, and so they use members of the opposite sex to feel like they're tough or, you know, that they're good-looking or whatever they need to feel in that moment. You could use... Video games are a good example. I used to use video games all the time. You know, I would go home and I would be really pissed at my life and I would be like, I want to go kill something. I'd go on video games and I'd kill things on the video. I'd be like, yes, you know, and that's how I was dealing with my anger and my justice. And it's like, did it work? Well, not really, right? It would give me momentary satisfaction for sure, but then guess where my problems were still where? Still there, right? It didn't solve any of my problems. Like all the stuff I was angry about was just waiting for me when I came back, right? So it didn't actually help. some people turn to drugs and alcohol. And once again, you know, a lot of my friends that used to drink, my buddies in the Marine Corps, when they drank, they weren't drinking to have a good time. They were drinking to forget. You know, they were drinking way too much. And it's like they're getting drunk to try to forget about pain that's happening in their lives. But where's the pain at? It's still there. And right when they sober up, they're going to get hit with it. So it's like it's not making anything go away. Do you guys understand what I'm saying? It's a nothing. They're worshiping nothings. And Jacob understands that. And he looks in his life and he realizes where all these nothings have gotten his family. And he's like, dude, we're worshiping these gods. And if you study the gods of these people, the Mesopotamians, you know what kind of gods they served? Were they serving like really loving gods that were like, dude, like go love each other and dude, everything's cool and let's all hold hands and just forgive. Is that the kind of gods that they serve? No, dude, they're serving gods that used to like, there's stories about them like disemboweling their enemies and like making kingdoms out of the carcasses of their fallen and, you know, like, eating babies and shoving swords up people's fingernails and like, you know, like they, the most gruesome, brutal gods ever. And that's who these sons are worshiping. So it's like, do you think that might have an impact on the way they act? You know, it's like, dude, they're worshiping these gods who are like, kill, 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 kill. And then they go and they kill. And should we be surprised? Should we be like, oh my gosh, how did these people turn out to be so violent? You know, like, there's no way, you know, that how could this happen? You know, that's what makes me laugh. You know, when I go to the Middle East and these people are so violent, people are like, how could these people be so violent? Have you read their literature? Have you read it? Right? There's literature in the Quran where Muhammad says, fight the unbelievers and slaughter them where you find them. It's like, what? How could you read that and be like, I think I'm going to live a life of peace. You know, like this is the document that I'm going to follow, but I think I'm going to live a life of peace. I'm going to go against this. It's like, no, there's no way you would do that. You know, or like you go into the Hadith and Muhammad says, I wish that I would be slaughtered in battle that I may come back to life and then fight and kill and then die in battle and then come back to life and then fight and kill and come back to life and then get killed and then come back to life. And that's one of his sayings. And you're like, dude, how could you live peaceful following a guy who says stuff like that? You know, people in America are like, I don't get it. You know, Islam is so peaceful. You know, I just don't understand. And, you know, like just this week, some dude tried to run a car into Parliament. You guys read about that? And he stabbed some cop to death. And what did he do? He was a follower of ISIS, right? He's yelling Allahu Akbar as he's stabbing people. And people are like, I don't know what motivated his attack. I don't get it. You know, it's a mystery to all of us. And we're like, yeah, how much more clear could he be? You know, like what else could he do to show that Islam is motivating what he's doing? And this is the important thing that we need to understand. The things that you worship, these nothings that you look up to, they're impacting you. They're impacting you one way or the other. The way I treat women. You know, the question I need to ask myself is, where am I learning? Where am I learning how to treat women? You know, is it from God? Or is it from the nothings that I like? You know, the shows that I watch. Maybe some family members that I look up to. Maybe it's my friends. Maybe, right? How do I treat women? How do I treat my life? How do I treat my career? All these things are influenced by what's influencing me, by the things that I'm looking up to. You guys get that? So we need to really watch what we look up to, because it will have an impact on us. And Jacob realizes this. He realizes the gods that we followed have totally led us off course. And we need to get rid of these things, and we need to follow God. We need to cleanse our lives. We need to cleanse our hearts. We need to get rid of these things and really dedicate ourselves to the Lord. And at some point in our lives, this has got to happen to us too. It's like if we're looking at Jacob's life as being like that of a Christian, obviously he's under the old covenant. But if I were to look at Jacob's life, is he saved at this point? Is he saved? I would say he is, right? God says that, dude, you're my guy, you know, and he gives him a new name. He gives him a new identity. He's saved. But is he backslidden? Yeah, he's pretty backslidden, right? And at some points in our life, we can give our lives to God, but then we don't change anything. And that's the point of the Bible. You can give your life to God and not change at all. Right? I was meeting with some people just a little bit ago. And they're both Christians. They're both believers. But their lives are just a wreck. And I started going through it with them. I was like, you know, like, well, this is the stuff that's wrong with you. It's like, well, where did you learn how to treat your wife that way? And he's like, well, I guess it's always worked for me because, you know, I was hurt as a young guy. You know, I had a girlfriend that cheated on me. I was hurt, and I always told myself I would never let someone take advantage of me like that again. And so I've always kind of held all of my girlfriends and relationships at arm's distance ever since then. I was like, well, is that working in your marriage? He's like, no, it's not really working. It's kind of ruining my marriage, actually. It's like, okay, well, don't you think you should probably stop? He's like, well, I know I should stop, but I don't know why. Like, I wouldn't want to leave myself open to get hurt again. So I don't think I will. It's like, okay. And then I looked at the wife. I was like, okay, well, why are you allowing him to treat you this way? And she's like, well, I've never really had anyone love me in my life. So, you know, if this is what I got to do to be loved or cared for, then I guess this is what I got to do. I'm like, okay, well, is it working? Like, is he loving you? She's like, well, no. It's like, okay, so he's abusing you. You're allowing him to abuse you, but you're allowing it to happen because you're afraid of leaving him. Who's that going to work out for? She's like, well, probably no one. I was like, okay, well, all right. So you got to change, right? You understand you got to change, right? And they're like, oh, yeah, I think so. I don't know. And what they're saying to me in their speech is that they know that God is real. They know what they have to do, but they don't want to give up what they have. Why? Why don't they want to give it up? Because they're scared. In order to pursue God, in order to really pursue God, you have to give up the nothings that you've been relying on. Because, hey, you know what? Me using pornography as a stress reliever and an anxiety reliever, it's a pretty weak anxiety reliever, but at least it's something. You know what I mean? It's better than nothing. That's what I tell people. You know, porn sucks, but it's better than nothing. You know, hey, being violent sucks, but it's better than nothing. You know, taking revenge on people is terrible. It's going to have a lot of consequences on your life, but it's better than being a pushover, right? You know, so like it's better than the alternative. That's the only thing I could say. And what Jesus is telling us, what the Bible is telling us, is unless you really see God as being better, how are you going to be able to turn away from the nothings that you have? You guys understand that? It's just not possible. You can't do it. You got to really genuinely know that God is better than what you've been turning to, or else you won't be able to do it, and you won't be able to cleanse your life the way that Jacob is doing right now, saying, dude, I'm going to put everything down that has been leading me astray. Everything is going away from my life. Dude, I'm making, we call this in Christianity, we call this amputation, right? Whether it's relationships that need to be cut off, whether it's, sometimes it's devices for a lot of guys that I counsel, for me as well, I have to put filters on my computer and stuff like that. Why? Because if I don't have filters on my computer, the temptation to view pornography on it is really strong, and I'm very weak, and so because of that, I need to amputate certain things, right? Not that there's anything wrong with the internet, but for me it is, right? I needed to, you know, down the road, I needed to stop playing video games. Not because video games are evil or wicked, but for me they were, right? For me it was a nothing in my life that I needed to get rid of. So taking that inventory in your life and realizing, man, if I want to pursue God, there might be some stuff I need to cut off and be pretty radical about. That's what Jacob's realizing. And so he makes this decision to do so. The other thing I want to call to attention is where God is telling him to go. How's it going? It's where God's telling him to go. He tells him to go to Bethel. Now, you guys probably don't remember this, but Bethel is the place where Jacob first met God. So after he deceived his dad and ran away, he went to Bethel and he met God for the first time. This was the first time he actually encountered God. And God is now telling him to go back to Bethel. The easiest way to think about God in our relationship with him is God is like he's like a really, really good teacher. Really, really good teachers don't give up on you. They keep teaching until you get the message. Bad teachers give up on you, right? Bad teachers are like, you know what? I know you're not getting this, but I don't really care. You know, get out of my class, right? I'm gonna pass you. Get out of my class. Never come back. You know, I'm tired of teaching you. That's what a bad teacher does. A good teacher will never give up on you. And it's that persistence that kind of pisses us off about God a little bit. Like, can't you just let this go? I mean, you've been trying to teach me this for years and years and years, and I've never learned it. Why can't you just stop trying? You know, just let me get away with this, you know? Just let me just move on. And God's not like that. He's like, dude, you're gonna get the lesson. You're going to get the lesson. And so if you see what God's done, it's actually kind of brilliant. God has taken Jacob, and after 20 years, what he's saying to Jacob, you have made zero progress. You've traveled hundreds of miles. You've spent 20 years and you've made zero progress. You are in the exact same spot you were 20 years ago, running away from your problems, scared to death, and knowing that you can't take responsibility for what you've done. You're the same dude. You made the same decisions, and now guess what? I'm going to call you back to the same place because you need to deal with this stuff. We're not going to move on. We're not going to move forward until you're ready to deal with it. So what we're going to do right now is we're going to talk about this meeting with God, and we're going to compare it to, and I want you guys to tell me, we're going to compare it to the first time you talked to God. I'm going to show you guys the stories in parallel, and I want you guys to tell me, like, what's different about this time. So let's move forward. It says they journeyed there, and then in verse 8, something tragedy hits. One of Jacob's concubines ends up dying, and so he gets kind of bummed. But then he moves on in verse 9, and he says, then God appeared to Jacob again when he came to Paddan Aram, which is the same exact place that God met him the first time. And God said to him, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name. So God's reaffirming to him. He's like, dude, your name is Jacob. You are a deceiver. You're still the same guy. But he's like, but not anymore. I'm changing you. I'm giving you a new identity. So he called his name Israel. Also God said to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac I give to you and to your descendants after I give this land. Then God went up from him to the place where he talked with him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him, Bethel. So let me compare this real quick. So if you guys have your Bibles, go back to Genesis 28. Okay, and you're going to see the parallels. In Genesis 28, this is verse 13. So Jacob sees his ladder, and this is what happens. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham your father and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Same exact promise he gives him in Genesis 35. And he says, also your descendants shall be as dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And you and your seed and all your families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. And Jacob rose early in the morning, took the stone that he had put at his head, set up a pillar and poured oil on top of it. And he called the name of the place Bethel, but the name that the city had been Luz previously. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house, and all that you give me, I will surely give you a tenth. Okay, so what differences do you guys see between Genesis 28 and 35? He's accepting of God. Yeah. He's willing to give him tithes. You know? And that was in Genesis 28. But notice in Genesis 35, right? In Genesis 35, he really doesn't say anything. It just says in verse 13, after God talks to him, verse 14, sorry, Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it, poured oil on it, and Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him, Bethel. So you notice Jacob doesn't say anything? In Genesis 28, what did he say about God? If what? Do you see kind of he's still trying to kind of make an agreement with God, right? He's still trying to get his way. Do you guys see that? That he's like, God, you'll be my God if you do this. You know, then you'll be my God. In Genesis 35, does he put any conditions on God? No. He just goes before God and he does a drink offering. Drink offerings are interesting. We'll get more into them when we get into the book of Numbers. It's probably going to be like a year from now. But anyway, when we get into the book of Numbers, we'll talk more about drink offerings. But what a drink offering was, is it was the idea of pouring out everything before God. Right? Saying like, God, it's all yours. And so you would pour out something like really precious to you. He pours out, it says that he pours out water. And for those of us who live in the desert, we know why water would be very valuable. thing to pour out, right? He pours out water, and that was a, it was a symbol of showing, like, God, I trust you. You know, everything I have is poured out before you, and I just, I'm giving everything to you, and I'm trusting you. And what Jacob is saying in Genesis 35 is he's saying, once again, no matter what, God, you are my God. I'm not going to try to deceive you anymore. I'm not going to try to lock you into a covenant or something like that. I'm just going to trust you're my God. I don't have anywhere else to turn. I have nothing else to barter. I have nothing else to give you. Jacob realized, to put it another way, Jacob finally realized that when he came to God, God wasn't getting something in return. Which is something that a lot of Christians need to learn. A lot of us think that when God saves us, God's getting something out of it. That he's like, man, thank the Lord that Peter gave his life to me. You know, I don't know what I would do. You know, who would teach the high school ministry if Peter didn't do it? You know, if he wasn't faithful, what would I do? You know, Calvary would certainly fall into the dust of disrepair if Peter wasn't there. You know, I mean, there's no way that anything could have happened. And, you know, a little bit in my heart, I may not put it that way, but a little in my heart, I'm like, yeah, you know what? I do a lot for the Lord. You know, I mean, I know he saved me, but I kind of know why he saved me, you know, because I do a lot for him, you know, and a lot of people are like, man, I give so much money and tithes. What would these ministries do without my money? You know, they would fall apart. You know, God certainly is getting the good end of the deal here. And that's what Jacob is thinking. He's like, dude, God, you want to do something for me because I'm going to do something for you. That's why. Now, all of a sudden, you know what he's realizing? I have nothing to offer God but brokenness. I am a wreck of a human being. I've ruined everything. Dude, literally the entire country wants my head on a pike because I raised some jacked up sons who thought it would be a good idea to slaughter thousands of people and take their women as booty. You know, I'm a mess. I'm clearly a bad father, right? Like, you know, if one of your kids kills 1,000 people, maybe you need to think about your parenting skills. You know, maybe be like, yeah, maybe I'm not the best father figure, you know, that my kid would think that that was a good idea, right? And Jacob's finally realizing, dude, I'm a mess. There is nothing I have to offer God. And that means that everything that God does for me is out of mercy, not because he has to. And Jacob's finally realizing it, and it's beautiful. Another difference that you could see between the way that he treated God in Genesis 28 versus this time is God gives him a new identity. Right? Did you guys catch that in the beginning? In Genesis 28, he doesn't do that. And you might be like, why not? This is kind of weird. Because like I said, something's better than nothing. Even something broken is better than nothing at all. Jacob was a deceiver. But in his mind, he was like, but if I didn't deceive anyone, I wouldn't get anything. Does that make sense to you guys? So that name, Jacob, his identity as being a deceiver, was bad. But he's like, but it's better than being deceived all the time myself and being taken advantage of all the time myself. To put it another way, Jacob didn't realize that his identity as a deceiver was a bad thing, that it was something that needed to be given up. In Genesis 35, he's finally realizing that. There's something wrong with me. I need God to change me. And God allows him to do that. For a lot of us, we're the same way. Where we're like, I know I've made mistakes in the past, God, and thank you for forgiving me for that. But I think I'm a relatively good person, though. You know, I think I'm a relatively good guy. And God has to cleanse me of that delusion. He has to be like, Peter, those sins don't make you a sinner. You're just a wreck of a human being. You're a sinner, and that's why you sinned. You guys see the difference? See, it would be like somebody, like, you know, if I killed somebody. And be like, you know, that I killed somebody and that's what makes me a murderer. You guys could look at me and be like, no, you're just a psychopath. And that's why you killed that guy. And so you were already a murderer before you killed him. There's something wrong with your heart. There's something wrong with you as a human being that you would do that. You guys understand the difference? Jacob's finally ready to say, there's something wrong with me as a human being. It's not just something wrong with my actions. There's something wrong with me as a person that needs to change. And you can definitely see the difference inside of somebody who has character defects like this, right, in the way that they apologize to you. Let's say you got let me use an extreme example. Let's say you have a relative who is an alcoholic and he's incredibly abusive. And when he comes to give you an apology, he'll say something like this to you. He'll say, like, hey, I'm really, really sorry that, you know, I drank and that I drank that one time and beat you up. I'm really sorry, but I'll never do it again. And you might ask him something like, well, what are you going to do to make sure you don't do it again? And he's like, well, I just won't do it again. Now, in your heart, what do you know is going to happen again? He's going to do the same thing. Why? Because all he thinks he's done, he's like, yeah, I've done wrong actions, but he's never thought that maybe these wrong actions have come out of a wrong heart. Maybe the reason why I do these wrong things is because I'm a mess of a human being and I need help, right? I need to change. Fundamentally, my whole identity needs to shift. You guys understand the difference? You're not going to be able to change unless you come to this place as Jacob. You're like, dude, I need to change as a person. I couldn't just look at my life anymore and be like, well, yeah, I know I've made a wreck of some relationships and stuff like that, but I just won't do it again. I needed to come before God and recognize I will do this again unless you change me, unless you radically alter the way I think and the way I move and the way I feel. I'm going to do things very similar again. Jacob finally gets to the place where he's willing to say that. Now what happens as a result of God, of Jacob's repentance? Verse 16, then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, so he's going back home, by the way, to confront his dad, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had a hard labor. Now it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said to her, do not fear, you will have this son also. And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, which means son of my sorrow. But his father changed his name to Ben-Hamin, which means son of my right hand. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. Then Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. And it happened, when Israel dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard about it. So his family's just a wreck. And what you see happening to Jacob, and this is really the sign of someone who's truly repentant, someone who's truly wanting to change. Consequences of his previous actions are coming back to haunt him. If you've the last time we talked about the story of Jacob's wives and how they had a competition with one another, how Rachel and Leah had a competition with one another. And do you guys remember, what was that competition about? It was about kids, right? They're like, dude, whoever has the most kids wins. And they were both like, they were off to the races and they were trying to have these competitions with one another to try to one-up one another. And Jacob never looked at that and be like, hey, wives, you know, I love you the way you are. You know, you don't have to compete. You don't have to do. He was happy. He's like, dude, I'm having a ton of sex, which is great, you know, and they're having a bunch of boys, which is even more great, you know. And so he's just jazzed to the stars. He's like, man, I can't think of this going better. And now literally this competition has done what? It's literally killed his wife. Very literally, it's killed her. And she names it, like, all the names of the kids, by the way, like, you go through all the names of the kids, all the names were given to them as a result of the competition. And now her final kid, what has she named him? Son of my sorrow. Dude, the thing that I have looked to find my validation and worth and meaning in life has ended up killing me. And Jacob, how does he respond to this? Right? This kid has a name now of like, oh, I killed my mom. Like, he would grow up of being like, why is your name Ben-Oni? That's a weird name. Oh, it's because I killed my mom. You know? Be like, dude, that's a pretty rough identity to have, isn't it? And Jacob knows, Jacob's now gone through this whole period of his life where he realizes the burden a name could have on you. He's finally learning his lesson, and he looks at his son, and he says, you're not going to be named son of my sorrow. You're going to be named son of my right hand. Dude, I'm going to raise you up. You were born out of adversity, but you are going to be a glory. You're going to be a joy in my life. And he ends up favoring Benjamin in a really cool way in his life. But Jacob, you could see in this action, in this really small action, what he could have done is he could have blamed, right? He could have been like, God, how dare, you know, I just made this deal with you and now you're going to take my wife? Like, what is wrong with you? He could have been totally angry and upset, but instead he does this action showing that he realizes who's to blame. Me. He's finally owning his actions. He's not making excuses anymore. He's owning his actions, and it shows that his repentance is true and genuine. And we'll talk a little bit more about Bethlehem and stuff in a second here. But it also shows that, you know, Reuben, his son, ends up having sex with one of his concubines, which is pretty gross, even by their... So his concubine was one of his wives that he never really married. So Reuben came from Leah, who was one of his wives, and Reuben ends up having sex with one of Jacob's other wives. So to put it in modern context, it would be like if one of you guys had like a stepmom, and then your dad like divorced her, and then you went and shacked up with her. It's pretty gross, right? You know, that's kind of what's going on in the family right now. It's pretty nasty. Like, no matter how you slice the pie, like, his family's just a wreck. You know, like, so you think your family's a wreck, you got nothing on Jacob's family, right? You got mass murderers living in there, and you got dudes having sex with stepmoms, and it's weird, man. It's just a weird, weird situation that's going on. But in verse 27, I want to focus on verse 27, and then we'll kind of finish up. In verse 27, it says, "Then Jacob came to his father Isaac in Mamre, or Kirjath Arba, and which means city of Arba. But anyway, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had dwelt. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, so Isaac breathed his last and died. It was gathered to his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him." So Jacob, I mean, he gets to see his dad right before he died, and I guarantee you that Jacob was unbelievably happy that God made him do this. Because Jacob, you remember, which parent favored Jacob? The mom. The mom died before Jacob ever saw her again. Right? The consequences of his actions were so severe, he left. He never got to see his mom again when he left home. Never saw her again. She died. And now he finally gets to come home and see his father pass away. You know, but he got closure with him, which was important. The only thing worse than having to confront your problems is never receiving closure. That's terrible. That's a horrific curse to put on yourself, to never receive closure from an action that you've done. Jacob got to receive closure, and that probably meant the world to him. And it's important that we learn this lesson. The Bible puts it this way. It says, keep short accounts. Keep short accounts, because you don't know when your time's up. When I went over to Afghanistan, it became really clear to me that I could die any day. And when I was talking to my parents and stuff on the phone, I only got to talk to them like once a month on a sat phone, a satellite phone. And what kind of conversations do you think I had with them? You think I was like, "Mom, you remember when I was 5 and you favored my brother over me, and I can't believe you did that," or like, I don't really like how you celebrated my birthday when I was 12, you know, or like, do you think I brought up petty stuff like that? Why? Because I knew that this might be the last conversation I have with her. Does that make sense? And I don't want to die. I don't want to die with her not having that closure between me and her. You know, I want to be clear that, you know, I love her in these last times that I talked with her. When I came back from deployment, my sister and my mom and dad ended up getting into this huge argument that lasted 4 years. And they didn't talk to each other for 4 years. And you know what? Finally, they're talking again. You know what finally brought them back together, though? It wasn't me. I would have wished that was it. That was it. You know, because I told them both. I was like, dude, like, yeah, I told my sister. I was like, "Mom's pushing 60. She might die. And you may never be able to take back all the stuff that you said to her. How would you like that?" You know, and she, neither of them really thought about it. And then finally, my brother-in-law, he got diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and he's looking like he's on his way out. And finally, that was the moment where my sister Kirsten realized, wow, like, I don't want to die. I don't want to go out without closure. And they finally started talking with one another again. And finally, you know, my sister and my brother-in-law are coming back out here, you know, so please pray for them. But I mean, all that pettiness and stuff and all that division and all that weirdness happened because they were just not willing to confront one another over something that happened years in the past. You know, the Bible tells us, don't be like that. Don't be foolish like that. You know, you never know when you're going to die. You never know when the person you're arguing with is going to die. Get closure. You know, keep short accounts. Doesn't mean you have to be best buds with everybody. You know, that's not what it's saying. But it's saying at least, you know, if you hate your parents or whatever, that's fine. But at least get that closure where you're able to sit down with them and be like, you know, at least my dad knows that he loves me, you know? If you have someone in your life that you can't get along with, that's fine. But at least, do they know that you at least care for them? Or is the last conversation you have with them like, "I hope you die," you know, and then they're going to die. And you're like, "Oh, dude, like, that sucks," you know? You know, have keep short accounts. That's really important. The next chapter, I'm not going to read it. It's chapter 36. It just talks about Esau's family. Esau is the brother of Jacob. It's just a lot of names. You're not really going to get much out of it. But let me talk a little about this, about Rachel's death. With Ben-Oni and Benjamin and all this stuff that's happening in Jacob's life. What needed to happen in Jacob's life for him to really get is a lot of sorrow. A lot of pain had to happen in his life before he was able to get to this place. And if you notice, the place where she died was Bethlehem. Now, what happened that was special in Bethlehem? You guys think? What happens in the future special in Bethlehem? Jesus is born in Bethlehem. Now, isn't that interesting that he ends up being born in Bethlehem? And people are like, why Bethlehem? why not Jerusalem? Why not like something cool? You know, why this little nowhere town? And this nowhere town, the reason why it's special is because Rachel died there. That's what made it special. And that's why Jacob, it was special to him, because that was the place where he watched his wife die. And Jesus is born there. And you ask the question of like, why would Jesus choose to be born in a place that's like literally named after pain? You know, it's like that's literally how he got his name, after intense amounts of pain. And the reason why is honestly because of Jesus' specific mission. I'm going to read you guys a section from Isaiah 53. It says this: Jesus was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with deepest grief. We turned our backs on him and looked the other way. He was despised and we did not care. Yet it was our weaknesses that he carried. It was our sorrows that weighed down on him. And we thought his troubles were a punishment from God, a punishment for his own sins. But he was pierced for our rebellion, crushed for our sins. He was beaten so that we could be whole. He was whipped so that we could be healed. All of us like sheep have gone astray. We have left God's paths to follow our own. Yet the Lord laid on him the sins of us all. He was oppressed and treated harshly, yet he never said a word. He was like a lamb to the slaughter, and a sheep, and like a sheep that is silent before its shears, he did not open his mouth. Unjustly he was condemned, he was led away, and no one cared that he had died without descendants, that his life was cut short in midstream. But he was struck down for the rebellion of my people. He had done no wrong, he had never deceived anyone, but he was buried like a criminal, and he was put in a rich man's grave. Okay, so you see why Jesus might have chosen to be born in a place like that? Right, that Jesus is showing that he becomes that picture of Ben-Oni versus Ben-Hamin, that he is the son of the sorrow, the man of grief, acquainted with our illnesses. But that person who died as the son of grief became what? The son of God's right hand, right? You guys see the picture there, right? That Jesus bore our sorrows and iniquities, and through his brokenness we become whole. That's why he chooses this place to come to us. And if we want to learn how to be whole, we got to learn how to own the stuff we've done. If you want to be like Jacob and spend years of your life running away from consequences and trying to justify yourself, you can, but it's going to just leave you being paranoid and fearful, and it's going to ruin your life. When we're finally able to own things, the beautiful thing is that finally we would be able to feel what forgiveness feels like, that God's able to, again, bear your sins and iniquities on the cross, and you can be delivered from your guilt and your shame and your anxieties and your fears, and through his brokenness, he could heal all the brokenness in you. Because like I said, there's reasons why you do the sins that you do. There's reasons why I do the sins that I do. It's not just for no reason. There's brokenness that I'm trying to cover up. And if God doesn't fix that brokenness, I may not go back to porn, but I'm going to go to something. You guys get that? I need God to fix me. And it's at the cross that I find that healing and forgiveness. So let's pray, and then if you guys have any questions, you can ask them. I guess they're out already over next door, so you guys might have to leave. But yeah. Dear God, I want to thank you for your word. Thank you that we can learn, even from this really incredibly messed up family, God, we could learn lessons that we need to hear. I pray that you would teach us about our own brokenness, Lord, that we learn how to own our sin before you, that you could heal us, and that you could restore us, and that you could make us whole. In your name.